You're listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I'm sitting at the Public Records Office of Northern Ireland, and I have Steve Scott here with me. And for anybody who was ever trying to do any genealogical work or trace their family tree, there's a certain amount you can do online and there's a certain amount you can't, the availability of records online is in some cases restricted, in some cases is limited, and in some cases just is not yet digitized. And there are other records that you actually need either to go to somewhere like here or the archives in Dublin, or you get yourself somebody locally who will do research for you. Steve, thanks so much for taking a bit of time, and hopefully we can help some people if they're trying to navigate through their family trees and are hitting stone walls, that we can maybe knock a few bricks out of them here and there.
Nice, Austin. Hopefully we'll knock a few of those walls down.
So, the Public Records of Northern Ireland, in as far as you can in a nutshell, what extent of records are held here?
Oh, we've got about 56 kilometres of records. Pruny is the National Archive for Northern Ireland.
Okay.
And there is another National Archive which is in Dublin, and that's the National Archives of Ireland.
Yeah.
We complement each other.
Right.
And largely the two jurisdictions look after the records that live into each other.
Right. And of course, for most people doing genealogy and you get beyond a certain point, it was a 32 county record.
Yeah.
Functionality.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a complicated history with Irish record keeping, and one particular event in 1922 kind of dictated where we are now, and that was the destruction of the Public Record Office in Dublin,
right?
By fire during the Irish Civil War.
Yep.
Possibly, some would argue the biggest casualty of the Irish Civil War, which three decades of census material was destroyed,
right?
Plus a lot of parish registers and 800 years worth of history.
Yes,
went up and spoke in one evening.
Yes. So then, after the Civil War, after the establishment of Northern Ireland and the division of record keeping, a lot of that would be housed here.
Yeah, yeah. Certainly, when the two new states were created, there's effectively two new record offices created, and at the start, we started dividing material along the various counties,
right.
The six counties in Northern Ireland. Material came up north to Pruny. Some of it actually had never made it to Dublin, which was fortuitous.
Okay.
Which is partly why we have such a rich seam of material that has survived.
Okay.
Despite the catastrophic fire of 1922. A lot of church material, a lot of court material, hadn't actually transferred, and that survived, and that's one of the bonuses.
And of course, a lot of court material could include wills and probates, and
absolutely.
And now you're finding out who, because someone inherited,
absolutely.
You find out who the children are, etc.
Yeah, wills is a very important resource. As what we call a census substitute.
Right.
By far the best substitute is the church record,
right?
Which gives the most detail. Baptisms, marriages, deaths,
right?
And by far the most popular and in demand records that our users ask for.
And my understanding is church records oftentimes are, the condition of them are very dependent upon the care that was taken by the individual person. And that there was dampness, there was rats, there was all sorts of things that did damage.
Yes, the conditions are very much dependent on the material that we receive.
Yeah. When you said that way, you would have then had them digitally scanned. So when someone goes to look at a photocopy or a fiche, microfiche of something, it'll be in the condition that it was in.
We can make some enhances with digital technology. It's one of the bonuses of digital technology that you can sort of bring things more to the front and back. In terms of a medium, for engagement with the public, it's a better medium than microfilm, which has certain limitations.
So, jumping way down to the current day, do you then see that artificial intelligence is likely to enhance that access or improve on what you have already?
Yeah, well, I mean, AI is a very exciting development. You don't need me to tell you that. Every conference is awash with AI sessions. We're at the beginning of AI. Where it goes, I think is to be seen.
Right.
Certainly, I think in terms of, with this huge mass of information, it's not so bad for Irish records, but certainly for the American records,
yeah,
and
yeah.
The United ones. The sheer mass of data, I think AI offers some good great benefits,
right.
Especially when you're looking for keywords.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to look for Belfast, it's a bit challenging.
Yes.
You know.
Well, it's a bit like on any particular names.
Yes.
As well, if you're looking for Smith. You need a bit more than that.
Yeah, so I think AI, there's been some big developments in family history. We saw the explosion of family history TV programs,
right.
Which I think brought it to a national consciousness. I think the online censuses, took it to a new dimension. DNA obviously took it to a dimension. I think certainly AI looks to be the next breakthrough. How that will look, I think we'll only be able to see
when we get there and start looking back.
When we start looking back,
right? So you mentioned the records that are here. Then, of what you have here, how much of it, or what percentage, would be easily accessible by just typing on the keyboard? And then, what percentage are you looking at kind of having to do a little bit more manual labour?
For the international visitor, the bad news is it's under 1%.
Okay.
And it's probably closer to 0.0 than it is to 0.1. Prony has made available a number of electronic collections electronically, particularly the wills, which we mentioned earlier, and they go back to the 1880s.
Okay.
They are particularly useful, and I think we've got up to about the 1950s online. On site, you can look up that's a much more fuller database. We have records of property records, which are the valuation revision records,
right.
Which combine with Griffiths valuation, which is available on the Ask About Ireland website, and that's Griffiths takes you from the 1860s, but the valuation one takes you from the 1880s onwards,
right.
So complements the more widely known Griffiths one. So you can actually look up land records from the 1860s all the way through the 1920s online, and if you know how to use them, that's even better.
In genealogy, when you say, well, if you know how to use it, that, yeah, because again, these are all minefields.
They are minefields. Irish genealogy is contributed with problems around spelling, terminology.
Yes.
An Irish plantation mile does not equate to an English mile, just to complicate things.
And you say, when you come to spelling, of course, that the anglicisation of what would have been Irish names, and how the O was dropped, or the MAC and the MC.
Yeah, a town like Tander or Ye can be spelled 10 different ways.
Right.
That you just have to bear with it.
Yeah.
Again, I think technology can help us out with some predictive text.
Okay.
A lot of these were standardised in the 20th century. The townland names. So that's resolved some of those problems.
Okay.
Surnames is a different matter.
Yeah.
Whether you put an O in front of it, or you drop an O, or it's a Mac, or it's a Mac.
Yeah.
And you can't. Some people think you can ascertain a religion by the surnames. It doesn't even correlate to that.
Yeah.
The one thing about Irish genealogy is there's an exception to everything.
Okay.
There's no absolutes.
Right.
For every truism, we can find an example which bucks the trend.
There was a lot of bidirectional migration between Scotland and the north of Ireland, and I guess and that naturally results in intermarriage.
Yeah.
The people going over there find a Scot and then maybe come back, and vice versa. So again, the church records, and it's a case of being able to filter down to be able to see where some of those links have started when they...
Yeah, I mean, the Scotch-Ulster connection is a very interesting one, especially for Canada, you know, because, I mean, a lot of the Scots, they leave Scotland because they're not able to practice their Presbyterian religion.
Right.
They think they're going to have a bit more of freedoms in Ulster.
Right.
Within one generation, they find that's not the case.
Right.
And you can find first generation Scots who settled in Ulster then relocating to both the US and Canada.
Right.
And again, when they arrive in Canada, US or Canada, some of them arrive in the US and decide they want to go north.
Yeah.
Some arrive in Canada and decide they want to go south.
Yeah.
So it's another complicating factor.
So on that aspect of it, given that a lot of the particularly Canadian researchers could potentially have had their ancestors migrate to the US and then up into Canada, that trail, it may not, is there any of the aspects of what's here would help somebody be able to weave that trail?
There are, but I mean, the trail always starts recent.
Right.
You start from the recent and then you work backwards. You never do it the other way.
Well, no, yeah.
So you start, if you're tracing in Canada, you need to exhaust the Canadian sources. If they've come up from America, you know, the American sources, and then you hopefully, if you're lucky, can make that link between the passenger arriving in the North America and where they left from, which is, as I think most of your listeners will know, is difficult.
And yes, and I was going to say, I would have thought that might have been one of the better sources, because as I understand it, the manifest on a lot of ships was relatively, that at least the people's names were accounted for, if not necessarily details of where they came from.
That's true. There's a lot of ships' manifests have been itemized and are available online and various websites. Certainly the manifests of ships arriving, it tends to be that they're much better records for the passengers arriving in the New World than from where they
departed. Yes.
And again, it's difficult. It's more complicated when they leave. In the 18th century, most of them do leave from Ulster. In the 19th century, Liverpool is the is the main port
transport
departure, which complicates again. My ancestors went to Australia, and they go in the 1840s, just before the Great Famine, and they leave by way of Liverpool.
Okay.
You know, so there's no record of them leaving Ulster.
Right.
There's no record of them leaving Liverpool, but there is a record of the manifest of the ship.
Yes.
Which then arrives in Australia.
Right.
And so we know my great great grandparent and his son.
Yeah.
You know, they're both registered on that ship. So the manifest is a very good way.
So,
and they are mostly digitized.
And would they be available here? They're available online in a lot.
They're all available online. They wouldn't be prony. They're not prony records themselves. So it's our big successes are the surrogates for the census records that were destroyed.
Okay.
So very much the church records. If you, and again for the Canadian researcher, the more information you know, the better. If you come here and you say they're from County Antrim, the results are going to be few and far between.
Right.
But if you have that the information that ties into a specific townland,
right,
or a town, or at that time Ulster was very much a rural community.
Right.
You know, there weren't much in the way of cities, so most people did work on the land. So if you can tie them to a specific townland. And you know, and you've got the surname and the name. There's possibilities, and people, and there are success stories. People are able to, not everybody. So you know, it is very much a needle in the haystack. Some people can trace their family all the way back to the 17th century.
Right.
Some people come to a standstill about the 1840s.
Right.
And more often, if you can get to the 1820s, the 1840s, I think that's a success.
Okay, I guess I've been successful then. Because that's kind of where I'm hitting a wall.
Yeah.
Around the late 1820s.
Yeah. And it all comes down to records and what records have survived. because of the nature of Ireland's political past, it was subject to what was called penal legislation, which meant that a number of denominations were banned. They weren't allowed to practice, they weren't allowed to conduct marriages, yeah. They weren't allowed to have services, and those denominations are the Roman Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church itself.
Right.
Whereas the Church of Ireland was an established church, quite often, and quite often, somebody's family may be of Presbyterian stock, they may even be of Roman Catholic stock, but they're baptized in the Church of Ireland, even though their family never practice it.
Yes.
So that's just one of those nuances to be aware of.
Okay.
You know, that don't give up because a certain set of records doesn't exist.
Okay. And then, we talked about wills, newspapers. Yeah. Newspapers are often a very rich source because, be it that there's a births, deaths, marriages columns in them, and oftentimes there's court cases, which can be quite interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the brilliance about newspapers is that certainly in Ireland they go back centuries.
Right.
And the good thing about some of the newspaper, the online newspaper, platforms is that they continue to digitize, they continue to add, so it's not something that's staying static. You know, you can look at the British newspaper archive today, and then, you know, 10 months time there'll be more material on it,
right?
And what you don't find now, you may find then. But you're right, and again, it's all about the search tools with the online newspapers. It's if you search for, you know, a common term like Belfast, you're going to get a lot of results.
Right.
You need to narrow down, but, you know, and to be fair, all these platforms will facilitate you to narrow down by date, you know, and by keyword, you know, and that's definitely the way to.
So, given that newspapers can be such a valuable source, if I think in terms of births, deaths, marriages, is there a class structure issue here? In other words, you know, a certain percentage of the population would not have been announcing the birth of a new arrival or that they've got engaged or.
And you see this through Irish genealogy, full stop. You know, the and even when the census that survive, I mean, there's some entries that you're very suspicious of when one kid's 10, one kid's 15, one kid's 20. You know, it doesn't take a lot to imagine that the parents don't even know the ages of their of the child. So that is an issue. But again, I think it's just knowing that ages are rounded up.
Right.
I suppose it's one of the pitfalls is a bit of knowledge just to be aware that not all data is accurate. Certainly for the well-to-heel people, I think that's quite good. I have seen plenty of newspaper birth, marriages, and deaths which don't correlate to the census records.
Okay.
Or don't correlate to the church records. Which one's true? I think that only the person doing the research, I think, is best placed to.
Yeah, because I know that I've seen, even when I do census record searching for my own family, how suddenly in a 10-year period, the age difference between my great-grandparents either seem to have narrowed or expanded.
Yes. I mean, it's not just Irish ones. That's something that happens in census records worldwide. Yes, so that somebody's born in 1845, and for one census, the next one census, they were born in 1842.
Yeah, and of course, a lot of women didn't want to reveal their true age.
I'm not sure how. I'm not sure about that one. I wouldn't call it.
Well, you know, there was a time when it was impolite to ask a woman her age.
But I suppose the lesson is always sort of be a bit wary of, you know, of dates.
So in other words, don't have an expectation that you're, if you think you have an ancestor who was born in a particular year, it could be within plus or five, minus five
absolutely.
Years.
So and don't just rule somebody out because they're what, so, 1 or 2 years out.
So then, Steve, if I've done all my research that I can online and I arrive in here, what would I be finding here that I would not have been able to find online specifically?
Well, we have not put our church records online.
Right.
It's a big resource. And also we'd need to actually have the agreement with the churches as well.
To do that.
To do that. So that's a big one. But we also have a lot of records. And you mentioned, you know, the poor postcodes. Border guardians.
Okay.
You know, certainly in the 1840s, the border guardians looked after the poor, administered the poor law.
Okay.
And so you could either go into, for a lot of the people claiming poor law assistance, they could actually stay in one of the border guardians, or they could turn up and just get food. And those border guardians were interested to record details of that.
Okay.
So they record the names, you know, what sort of assistance they had, their addresses, what their occupations was, you know, which, you know, for a lot of the women it could be something a bit more unsavoury.
Right.
You know, and it records some of the status of some of the children, you know, whether they were born in wedlock or outside of wedlock.
Right. Right.
So there's a lot of social information.
Right.
On border guardians. Street directories, you know, very useful. Sourced certainly for the male householders.
Yeah.
You know, Prony has digitized our 19th century ones.
Okay.
20th century ones are still hard copy.
Okay.
School records is another great source.
Okay. And again, they're not digitized. That's coming in and sitting down and researching.
Yeah, they're not digitized.
Now, school records, you're talking, these would be effectively the role of attendees at the start of the year or something like that.
They can be, or they could be the register. There can be the register, which would list the people at the start of the year, or rule books where the registers don't exist, and the rule books would be.
And would that be elementary school or
in the main elementary school?
So you're getting a young age, and at that stage, you have a good assessment of, well, if it's a new entry into a elementary school, they're between 4 and 6 years of age, probably.
So, I mean, the education system was pretty far, you know, it was well implemented in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so certainly by the 1880s, you're covering a huge amount of the population on the school side. Now we've got a fairly good set of school records, certainly for the 1870s and 80s. They do dip out as far as the 1830s. I should say not that many go as far back as the 1830s, but certainly the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, there's a good cross section.
And these again would mean public schools as distinct from private schools.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's what's called the national school.
Yeah, but that mean when you get to high school level or secondary school level.
We don't have many. We've got one or two high schools, but that's not really been part of our collecting remit.
Okay.
And there's an intent. When we Pony was first set up, we knew we had very little census material, so our early deputy keepers, they scoured the country looking for what they considered to be substitute records.
Right.
School records were one of those that they had identified.
I've seen recently that you talked in terms of reconstruction of lost census records. I've seen recently somewhere that some of that process is happening, certainly at the National Archives in Dublin, I think. And I presume that it's in collaboration and you're working
it
on
is.
It.
The project is called the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland.
Yeah.
Trinity College Dublin are the lead on that, and they have digitally recreated the Public Record Office of Ireland as it was when it was destroyed.
Okay.
We actually have a full inventory of what was destroyed, which was actually compiled only about 1 or 2 years before the destruction. So we know what actually was lost in the destruction, in the fire, which has helped in a way in that we know what could replace.
Right.
That, so it wasn't just a matter of going around to Ireland. It was a matter of going to English institutions Sometimes you'd, for every public document, there's nearly always a second copy.
Okay.
So for in terms of government records, a second copy would have been sent to London.
Right.
So quite a lot of material has sort of been restored that way.
Okay.
America itself and Canada, you know, is also, you know, with we find materials that act as, you know, surrogate materials.
Yeah.
So Canada and America have both played the role,
right,
you know, in contributing to trying to salvage what was lost.
So from an archivist perspective, this must be very exciting.
It is exciting. I mean, we can only ever find what still survives.
Right.
You know, you're still about 60-70% of the information, you know, is probably, you know, not going to be retrieved. Another interesting one, and this is actually more the National Archives of Dublin, is that fragments and almost burned records were salvaged after the fire, and they just put them in boxes. And now technology has caught up in such a way that they can actually read that material.
The ash and nearly, read the ash and nearly.
Yeah, because I mean, what happens in a fire is there's always, nearly always, water.
Yep.
Comes in, so documents which have been sent to a fire suddenly are covered in water, which makes them very difficult. Yeah, everybody's saying that.
And the stick and everything. Yeah.
That. But now the technology is at such a state that we can, well, maybe not always, but we can read some of that material.
Fascinating.
So that's certainly cutting edge.
And when this type of additional material will take time to come online.
Yeah.
But so I suppose in the next 5 to 10 yeah. years, there'll be a lot more of what would be historical data like that becoming available.
Yeah, I mean, some of it is already online on the Virtual Record Treasury Ireland website, which I'd certainly encourage any users to spend an evening.
Right.
You know, going with it.
So start an evening and spend a week.
Yeah, there's a lot of name-rich sources out there.
Right.
They've done a good bit of focus on things like religious censuses.
Okay.
You know, which were very name-rich. And there's another way into, you know, finding census material that no longer exists.
Right.
And there's quite a lot of religious censuses for the 18th and 19th centuries.
Okay.
The quality of information differs. You know, it's not always as good, but if you can get names and you can get places, you know, that's a positive. And a lot of people have had some success.
Talking in terms of logistics, if somebody wants to come and visit here, you're open, what, 5 days a week or 6 days a week?
We're open Monday to Friday.
Okay.
Normal business working hours. We don't require booking.
Okay.
You know, so, but we do require that you bring photographic ID. And it's heartbreaking turning away somebody from America or Canada who turns up without their passport.
Right.
So please bring your passport.
So would you accept, like, I have an Ontario driving license. Would that be accepted?
Actually, that would be fine.
Okay.
If it
has a photograph and a signature.
If it's
date of birth.
If it's photographic ID, that will accept.
Okay.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
I cannot make this plea strong enough.
Okay.
Because we really don't like telling people.
Oh, I can imagine, yeah. So make sure you have photo ID. Yes. Government issued photo ID.
Yeah, so we're open 5 days a week. You don't need to book. We do actually have a online search service.
Okay.
Which is a paid service, which will do a very basic genealogy search through some of the more popular sources, so that's basic church records, school records.
So then, while that's chargeable, that's on a
that
one
is chargeable.
And that's on a once-off, but could somebody take out an annual subscription
we don't do it. It's not done by a subscription, it's done by case by case.
Okay.
But, I mean, it's useful for somebody who can't make it over.
Yeah.
As I say, it's not the fully comprehensive service. We're not a genealogical research service.
But again, let's say I'm doing a bit of research and I'm not going to be able to achieve it in one afternoon.
Yeah.
So I know I'm going to have to be coming back on it. Am I looking at it once off on the particular topic, or each time I come back on as a subscription?
It would be a particular query. I mean, normal queries would be, I'm looking for my great grandfather.
Yeah.
You know, this is his address. Have you any records? And we will do a search for that.
Okay. Now, let me get this. So when you do that, then the subscription, then a human at this end.
Yes.
Okay. So what we're doing,
it's not an AI search.
This is a human at this end of the plan that's now going to go and search the physical records.
This is a human search.
Okay. Okay.
So we will search church records, some of the very basic ones, half a dozen other key sources, you know, tithes. Apartment, you know, the school records, and we'll come back and it's not prohibitive price. If you want copies, that costs more.
Okay, so on average, or to give a sense of, in what type of a range of cost could somebody expect to?
I think, you know, in terms of American dollars,
Canadian dollars, even sterling.
Sterling, I know sterling.
Yeah, tell me sterling.
Sterling, I think £20.
Okay, you know, so maybe $30.
Yeah,
$35.
You know, it's not prohibitive cost.
Yeah.
We don't make. There's no profit.
Yeah.
It's cost recovery.
Yeah, but it's just not prohibitive. It's not going to cost you $500.
It costs a bit more if you want a digital image.
Right.
You know, but that's not
prohibitive either.
That's not.
If you're that interested, it's not. Yeah. 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 Indeed.
And the one thing that has is obvious is that people are prepared, as we see with that, the payments to the online subscriptions. They are prepared to pay.
Pay
for data.
Yeah,
you know. So it's far from the most expensive.
Right, Steve. I'm going to let you go because I do really appreciate you taking the time. What we need to do is provide people with the online coordinates of where they should be doing logging in, and if any other details like that.
We're fairly easy. You put Public Record Office in Northern Ireland into Google, or whichever is your preferred search engine.
Yes.
And that will take you to what is our current web address.
Okay.
Now, should own up, or as we say in this part of the word, fess up,
right,
to that we are moving our website this year, and will be, and the new web address will be www.prony.gov.uk.
Right.
And actually you can access us now with a redirect anyway.
So the easiest thing probably would be to put in, as you say, Public Records of Northern Ireland or Prony Belfast,
and it will take you to the website. Yeah.
And are there any other resources that we should be directing anybody to?
I would certainly wholeheartedly recommend the National Archives of Ireland, which will be
Archives.ie,
which will be launched in the 1926 census.
Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
This year, and I should note that that census is for the 26 counties of the Irish Republic.
Yes,
so it's not included as six counties of.
And what's the story with six counties from 1921-22 on?
This is a bit of a tragedy. there was a census done in 1926. The returns went to England to be enumerated and never returned. At that point, it was not a devolved piece of government, so it was Northern Ireland didn't have any, you know, say in it. The suspicion is the returns were pulped during the Second World War.
Right.
So I'm afraid you're going to have to wait till 1937 for the next full census.
Right.
So I do apply for the National Archives of Ireland, particularly their census. Online records coming out. Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland, I think, is a great new resource. For Virtual Treasury of Ireland, just put Virtual Treasury of Ireland in your search engine, and that'll take you to that website, and it gives you lots of interest and stuff. Ask About Ireland gives you Griffiths Valuation, very, very important one. And also births, marriages and deaths are available online on the
genealogy.ie
website, and that's free. All those sites are really useful.
Steve, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been fascinating, and I do really appreciate it, and hopefully we can have some more traffic on your research and some people coming through your doors.
Thank you, Austin.